south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
So the question is, and it's probably a rhetorical question, are you addicted to the news cycle like pretty much the rest of the world is these days with the coronavirus? Are you glued to the internet and your smartphone? Just sucking in all those conflicting bits of information. Man, you know, these days you can't tell what's bullshit and what's not. Good example, wearing masks. You know, I was just at the grocery store, and you know, it seemed like I was the only one there without a mask. Why? Because just recently, in fact, just this morning, I listened to another one of those viral epidemiology experts. This guy wrote a couple of books on the subject, and he said 95% of the masks you see out there suck in air from the sides, so they're not protecting themselves from others with that mask. They're protecting others in case they start coughing or launch a loogie, both of which will end up in the mask. And of course, we're supposed to believe what the government says in all their press releases, etc., when in reality, all the government has done in the past 50 years is perfect the art of making bad things worse. Take masks, for example. Did you know the country's stockpile of N95 masks, according to the U.S. National Health Service, is only enough to meet 1% of the estimated 3 billion masks needed by our healthcare workers during a countrywide pandemic such as this? Because, you know, you got to keep changing those things. You can't wear them day after day, just like gloves. You know, routinely, physicians and dentists change their gloves between patients or if they touch a counter or a doorknob. Yet you see millions of civilians walking around with gloves that they never change until they rip, puncture, or break. So again, the estimate is 3 billion masks are needed in the U.S. and there's only 1% available right now. And that number's just for U.S. healthcare workers. So then why is that? Why isn't the market responding as it should and pick up the slack? And why then haven't other companies with similar machines retooled just a little bit? That should take about a half a day. You know, mask making is 1950s technology. It's not rocket science. Plus, we have all those CNC robotic machines now that can be programmed in an instant to produce all kinds of cloth and paper products. So then why, after, what, a month into this virus thing now, are they projecting an extreme shortage of masks? Well, wouldn't you know it, you can put the finger on lard-ass government slugs and their idiotic red tape and regulations. It's because the feds are still requiring new manufacturers to get FDA approval first, which takes from 45 to 90 days. And that's the reason so many companies are pivoting to make hand sanitizer rather than masks. Why? Less red tape. Turns out the amount of hurdles you have to jump through in order to get approval for masks is beyond absurd. Meaning it's impossible to make enough masks in time to help during this pandemic without breaking the law. Actually, a number of laws. And this, friends, is your benevolent government. Worse yet, on top of all of that stifling bureaucracy, we've got this new breed of so-called democratic socialists, or social democrats, who are so insistent on having the government run a national healthcare system. As if government is so good at what they do. Like, for example, the U.S. Department of Education. It's good, in fact, great at spitting out seniors who can read and write at the fourth grade level. Then there's the Department of Veteran Affairs and the VA. They're so good at what they do, there are only 17 veteran suicides per day. I tell you, the counselors and psychologists at the VA must be proud. Then you've got the U.S. Defense Department. They're so good at what they do, they've got the price of toilet seats down to a rock bottom $600 apiece. And hammers, they've managed to whittle down to only $200 a pop. You gotta hand it to those geniuses in the purchasing and procurement department, huh? Oh, and to get your GI laundry done, only $200 a bag. By the way, I was just talking to one of my engineering buddies who works for BMW, you know, the premium German car maker. He tells me that there are around 30,000 individual parts from screws to bolts to washers in every regular BMW sedan, you know, the typical one that costs maybe $50,000, they outsource a lot of those other parts to other manufacturers like Bosch. Things like glass, paint, grommets, screws, lights, trim, wiring harnesses, etc. from approximately 1,100 companies in the supply chain. That's normal, nothing unusual about that. Except to say that he and some of his engineering buddies over there in Stuttgart, Germany, that's where the plant is, he said he and his engineering buddies got into a thought experiment around the water cooler. He said they tried to estimate what it would cost for the government, in that case the German government, but it applies to the American government too, to produce a car like that, not to design it from scratch and then assemble it, but having all the blueprints. Then giving those plans to a government agency like the Defense Department, NASA, Navy, Air Force, Army Corps of Engineers, then task them with the job of building a BMW, exactly like one that would roll off an assembly line in Stuttgart. And they estimated the way government works and the way the appropriation systems work, it would cost, by their estimates, $100 million and take 5 years to produce one car. In other words, every one of these engineers at BMW knew the last thing you want to do, if you want to produce an excellent product at a reasonable price in a short period of time, is to task that job to a government agency. That's the kiss of death. Because, I repeat, the government, and it doesn't matter which government we're talking about, has perfected the art of inefficiency, of making easy things hard, bad things worse, and ostensibly cheap things ridiculously expensive. They perfected the art of going over budget, and they invented the term cost plus. You probably know what that means. When a contractor, for example, for NASA, when they need landing gear for a moonshot, they go to their usual suspect contractors like General Dynamics or McDonnell Douglas. The low bid, let's say, is $30 million, with a finish date of 10 months. And when 10 months rolls around and it's not done, and that's usually the case, they revert to the cost-plus mode. That's why practically everything government contracts out, especially with NASA and the Defense Department, go routinely 2, 3, and 4 times over budget. Because, you see, that cost-plus thing is written right into the contracts. Everybody knows it's part of the game. That's why defense contractors attach themselves to generals and such like leeches. That's why retired generals, congressmen, and cabinet members end up on corporate boards in companies like General Dynamics. So cost plus, even though it kills the taxpayer, is a government contractor's bread and butter. Meanwhile, defense contractor CEOs and board members continuously pay themselves $1 million bonuses year over year, even though their contracts run 2, 3, even 4 times over budget. In fact, that's one of the main reasons they can pay themselves $1 million bonuses. They absolutely count on that cost-plus language being written into those contracts, though they'll never admit it, except amongst themselves behind closed doors. Now, as for me, I believe almost nothing the government tells me. And many times I believe just the opposite. For example, just yesterday, the head of the FDIC, you know, that's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, that's the one that's supposed to guarantee your deposits at the bank up to $250,000. Now, the FDIC was created during the Great Depression when there was a huge run on the banks and banks went broke, so millions of little guys on the street lost all their dough with no recourse. So anyway, yesterday, the head of the FDIC put out a YouTube, a video, public service announcement that's already been viewed by 10 million plus people, with a nice lady standing at a podium next to the American flag and the great big seal of the president of the good old US of A, saying, "Stay calm. This is not the time to panic. We got you covered. The FDIC is here for you." She even said, "Don't put your money under your mattress." Yep, she even mentioned the old cliche mattress thing. "It's not good," she said, "to have a lot of money on you or in your house." "Don't worry," she said. "The banks are completely safe. We got them covered." Then she said, since the FDIC was founded in 1933, not a single American with a bank account has lost a cent. Sure sounded good, sounded nice, but it was a complete f***ing lie. And I can prove it. If you take the value of the U.S. dollar in 1933, the dollar today has only 5% of the purchasing power of that dollar. So your money compared to then is worth 5 cents on the dollar. So in effect, under the watchful, caring eyes of the Fed and the FDIC, every dollar you have in the bank or in your wallet has lost 95% of its value. Meanwhile, the Fed and the FDIC keep telling us over and over the reason why they were created. The only reason they exist is to keep your money sound, strong, and safe, and thus attenuate the natural boom and bust cycle to keep the financial markets healthy. And they brag about it every time you stick a mic in front of their faces. when in fact they're the ones that created this huge financial bubble that just got pricked. And this has been going on for 80-something years, and yet none of them are wearing orange jumpsuits. Worse yet, you got 99% of the people on the street looking to the Fed for answers, like they can solve the problem. The ones that got us into this huge, unprecedented debt bubble in the first place. They blew up the bubble, and the coronavirus was just the pin that popped it. Oh, and by the way, that $6 billion bailout program that's in Congress? I noticed they mentioned something about a Fed crypto coin on page 1006. Now, I don't care a bit about a Fed coin, and I have zero confidence in government. I'm just bringing this up so you realize that bill's got over 1,000 pages. That means for sure nobody's read the whole thing. And naturally, it's just packed with pork. That's why the government can never do anything right, and they screw up everything they touch. Just imagine when they get to the national health care bill, and they will. That thing's going to be tens of thousands of pages. What a disastrous pork sausage that's going to be. Oh, and just one more thing about the Federal Reserve. Before 1913, the U.S. dollar was 100% gold-backed. Then in 1913, when the Fed was created, they pulled some real sleight of hand. They changed the rules so that the currency of the United States only had to be backed by 40% gold. In other words, at that moment, they were able to inflate the currency by 60%. By the way, that and the instituting of the brand new federal income tax in 1913 was how they paid for World War I. Wars are expensive. And you know, when people hear that, for the first 135 years of the United States' existence, there was no income tax, they look at you funny. They don't believe it. How could the government function or pay its bills without an income tax? Well, they did just fine through tariffs and liquor taxes, licensing fees, import taxes. So, in effect, 1913 marked the beginning of the end. The Treasury instantly inflated the U.S. dollar by 60%, and then came the Roaring Twenties and the Great Depression, and then World War II, and in 1944 was the Bretton Woods Conference. That's where all the Allied countries got together trying to decide what they were going to do with the monetary system after the war was over. And that's when the world went on the U.S. dollar standard. By then, all the Allied countries and their banks were loaded with U.S. dollars. A lot of it because millions of U.S. troops were stationed in Allied countries spending those dollars. Not only that, all the Allied countries had big U.S. loans and debts to pay back. That's when the U.S. dollar became the reserve currency of the world. To all the other world powers, it was as good as gold because it was backed by 40% gold. But in 1944, at the Bretton Woods Conference, the U.S. changed the rules for gold reserves again. At that point, they would not specify a gold reserve number anymore. In other words, it could fluctuate, always, as you may have figured, to the downside. And as the printing presses were cranked up, the gold reserves got smaller and smaller. And then, in 1971, Nixon took the U.S. completely off the gold standard. Why do you think he did that? Well, because at that time it was estimated that we only had 10% of our money backed by gold. And that meant if everyone in the world turned in their dollars for gold, only the first 10% that got to the gold window would get it. And at that time, a lot of smart European bankers figured that out. And they did start cashing in their dollars for gold. Back then, you could do that, you know, at some big U.S. banks and the Federal Reserve. To make it more understandable, realize that in 1970, the United States had $14.5 billion worth of gold reserves, with $45.7 billion in paper currency floating around the world. And if Nixon hadn't closed what they call the gold window, within a couple of years, the U.S. would have no gold left whatsoever. And that was the moment we went completely to a U.S. fundy money system. So with no gold reserve necessary, the printing presses were cranked up even higher. And that's what's brought us to this gigantic debt crisis we're in right now. And that's why, just in the past few years, Russia and China have been buying up gold like crazy. Not so much because they believe gold is going to skyrocket in price, though it will, because they know that the U.S. dollar as the international reserve currency is about to end. So even if China or Russia back their currency with just 10% gold, the smart money, big corporate money, banks and institutions, will rush out of dollars into a currency that's backed by something. Now, to show you just how much governments can screw up and distort things, in 1970, the price of gold was 35 bucks an ounce. A year or so later, when Nixon closed the gold window, gold shot up to its real price, 125 bucks an ounce. about four times its 1971 value, reflecting almost exactly the same inflated increase in the U.S. dollar supply over the previous 50-something years. So gold, or I should say the market, automatically adjusted itself to reflect the excess funny money rolling off the presses, a direct cause of inflation. So if you think that this week's announcement that the U.S. Fed is going to inject $8 trillion into the system, and that's going to solve or even cure some of the grave financial problems we're in right now, well, we'll get a dead cat bounce, all right. It's too much money not to. Now, to make this more clear, to shine a brighter light on it, note that as of February 12th, 2020, there was $1.75 trillion worth of Federal Reserve notes in circulation, actual physical paper money, 1.75 or 1¾ trillion dollars. With another $12 trillion spread out across the world in bank balances and computer ledgers. Not physical paper U.S. dollars, but computer ledger entries in banks, businesses, and financial institutions. And the Fed said it's going to inject $8 trillion into that system, with fully $2 trillion of that being actual paper money, printed money. That means in a couple of weeks or months, there'll be more than double the physical money supply floating around the world. Do the numbers. That, my friends, is what you call Venezuelan-style monetary policy. I repeat, there's just slightly less than $2 trillion floating around the world as paper money right now. And very soon, there's going to be at least another $2 trillion floating around. And the other $6 trillion they promised, those bank and financial institution computer ledger entries, that'll pump the markets for a while. It's like handing everyone on the deck of the Titanic an extra bucket. Makes you feel good for a while and relieves the panic, but doesn't solve the fundamental problem that the ship's got a fatally big hole in it. Which brings us back to our initial question for the day. Are you addicted to the coronavirus news? Are you glued to your screens and devices? Does every little news flash, message, and pop-up report steal you away from whatever you were doing at the time? Well, here's something we might expect. You know, Hollywood movies have always reflected the spirit and the feeling of the times. For example, if you see a black and white movie that's not an artsy movie, it's probably pre-1960. In fact, there are lots of telltale signs in every movie that perfectly reflect the time period they were filmed in. Just look at the telephones they use in movies. You can spot a 60s or 70s movie easily by what the people look like and the phones they use. In the 80s and 90s, suddenly people were using pagers. Remember those? Then there was the flip phone period in the late 90s, the BlackBerry phone period from 2000 to 2010, and in the last few years, the iPhone and the Android. And, of course, clothes and hairdos are movie time capsule giveaways, too. Then it seems like every third or fourth movie, there's a scene in New York City. And everybody knows before 9/11, a New York shot always had the Twin Towers in it. And before 1970, when the towers were built, there was always the skyline shot of the Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building. And now, post 9/11, we're back to skyline shots of the Chrysler Building and the Empire State. So why am I bringing this up? Because I guarantee you now, since the coronavirus thing, Hollywood's depiction of life on the big screen will change drastically too. It's certain that in the future, when we see a movie, we'll instantly know if it was filmed in the post-virus era. I predict from now on, you'll see social distancing, masks popping up everywhere, no more handshakes or cheek rubbing, a lot of gloves and fist bumping. Oh, and I foresee designer masks and designer label disinfectant gels, and a lot less facial hair. Except for maybe ZZ Top and my Aunt Louise and her gin rummy buddies. Why is it that old ladies get hairier in all the wrong places? Ain't nature cruel? Oh, and another thing. I'm sure there's going to be an explosion in online schools and universities. I predict most brick-and-mortar schools will just fade away. They probably should have done so a long time ago. I think those changes will be permanent. Oh, and there'll be a boom in hands-free technology, too. You watch. Regular houses will start having automatic doors. Bidets will start popping up in bathrooms. Speaking of bidets, what else did the French contribute to society? Let's see. The croissant, French toast, smelly cheese, the guillotine, and women with hairy armpits. The guillotine. Yeah, that one deserves a comeback, don't you think? But where were we? Oh, yeah. Talking about the effect the virus will have on water faucets, shopping carts, doorknobs, handrails, they'll all be redesigned for minimum cross-contamination. And I predict in bathrooms there'll be no more power hand dryers. As soon as you hit the button, you're circulating everyone's contaminated air. including stirring up bacteria and viruses that are best left in their rightful place on the toilet. You know, I never use those things. I just rush on out, grabbing the handle of the door with a Kleenex or paper towel. Meanwhile, back in Latin America, this side of the Costa Rican paper called The Star, it says, as of today, March 23rd, 2020, the Costa Rican government implemented several new sanitary measures to try and control the spread of the coronavirus in the country. One of these measures has caused much alarm amongst foreigners who live in the country and have legal status as residents. So now it doesn't matter if you're a permanent resident with a cedula or national ID. The new measure states as of Tuesday, March 24th, all foreigners who have legal residency in Costa Rica or regular status with a working visa, if they choose to leave the country for any reason, will automatically lose their residency status. Did you get that? After all the crap you have to go through and the year waiting to get that temporary or permanent residency, not to mention the money you had to fork over and the endless lines you had to stand in, they're saying if you leave the country, your residency will be revoked. Now, you have to wonder what this has to do with the spread of the virus. Look, if someone's leaving the country, that should be a good thing, right? One less carrier, one less burden on the healthcare system. Well, some gringos and expats in the know living in Costa Rica right now are saying the real reason is Costa Rica's economy is almost entirely dependent on tourism and gringos and expats living in the country. So you've got the tens of thousands of gringos and expats living there who've established businesses and bought land and houses, with a huge proportion of them receiving pensions and Social Security monthly from the states. And since nearly all gringos and expats living in Costa Rica have relatives back up in the states who they're worried about right now, that's why in this time of crisis they want to be with them. And thus tens of thousands have left or have made plans to go back home to the states to tough out the crisis with them up there. Well, the Costa Rican government knows when gringos leave, their cash, pensions, investments, and businesses leave too. And that makes Costa Rican officials extremely nervous because they depend almost completely on the gringo dollar. So then can we expect this new revolting development to spread to other Latin countries? Will Colombia, Chile, Bolivia, Guatemala, Nicaragua, etc. pull the same stunt? Well, it's my opinion that it only can happen in a country like Costa Rica that depends almost exclusively on tourism. It's a desperate measure that's going to piss off a lot of people. And I'm positive in the end, when things normalize, Americans, Canadians, and Europeans who had plans to move to Costa Rica will remember that idiotic move and be gun-shy. Of course, all you longtime listeners know I never recommended Costa Rica for gringos and expats anyway, except for a nice package vacation deal for a week or two. I would never recommend the place for anything else. Remember, I lived there for a couple of years myself. I had two houses and a business. I saw the signs back then, some 25 or so years ago. I sold everything and got the hell out because I knew it was only going downhill from there. And I was 100% correct. So as far as this latest thing, losing your residency if you happen to leave the country, go back home or whatever, if it happens to you, I've got no sympathy for you. I've been telling you over and over for almost 10 years now, Costa Rica is not the paradise you think it is. No matter what those retirement rags, Condé Nast Traveler, and International Living tell you, it's not a good place to have your plan B. It's first world expensive, the locals are jaded by the U.S. dollar and all the gringos, and there's a con artist on every corner. In fact, there are two con artists, one Costa Rican and one a gringo. Matter of fact, there isn't a single gringo or expat I know living in Costa Rica who has not been royally ripped off by someone, in most cases by another gringo and or his own personal lawyer. So again, I repeat, you've had more than fair warning. Right, enough said about that. In other Latin American news, this coronavirus thing is devastating the economies of a lot of Latin American countries who, even before the virus hit, were insolvent and on the road to bankruptcy. For example, we've got this article that just came out yesterday. It starts, Ecuador's Congress called on the government to suspend debt payments to free up cash to deal with the virus pandemic, prompting J.P. Morgan and Chase Company to warn of a general sovereign default as soon as next Tuesday. Why all of a sudden? Well, it wasn't all of a sudden. Turns out the South American nation of Ecuador has $3 billion in bonds due in 2028. They fell to 3.5 cents to a record low of 31 cents on the dollar. Talk about haircuts, huh? pushing their yield into extreme junk bond territory at 33%. Wow, wouldn't you just love to get 33% annual return on your money? Of course, but not with these Ecuador bonds, whose face value has dropped to 31 cents on the dollar. And it says Ecuador has about $320 million of debt due Tuesday, as well as coupon payments due later next week. Problem is, it says, to halt those payments will prove costly to Ecuador, preventing them from receiving $5.5 billion in financing from other lenders they have lined up, including the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and, surprise, surprise, the Chinese. Again with the Chinese lenders, huh? Oh, this is bad. It says Ecuador is the country that's got the most distressed sovereign credit rating that's not currently in default. Well, I bet that'll change next week. Then it says, head of research at EMSO Asset Management in New York, who is researching the problem, says, what's the point of Ecuador paying back those loans? They've only got $800 million on hand, and the principal and interest payments due this week are $600 million. And with the COVID-19 virus spreading like wildfire and a depleted treasury, they'll have little room to maneuver. Oh, and here's the capper. It says, because Ecuador uses the U.S. dollar as its currency, it can't print money like it could if it had its own currency to provide liquidity. Obviously, Ecuador can't print U.S. dollars. Now, doesn't that make you wonder? Ecuador uses the U.S. dollar and can't print them. Meanwhile, the U.S. has their printing presses going at warp speed. All right, we're getting near the end of the show now. And I'd like to remind you once again that my next Expat Insider Seminar will be moved up a couple of months to Friday, August 21st through Thursday, August 27th. Once again, we'll be putting boots on the ground in the Altiplano in Guatemala, Central America, as well as hitting the lowlands in El Salvador and the beaches too. This could be your last chance to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B. So if you're ready to drink from the fire hose and want to get your Plan B on steroids, before Uncle Sam makes it impossible to get you and your assets out of the country, just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll put you on my early bird list. Oh, and don't forget, wherever you are on your Plan B, you'll definitely need a copy of my 100-plus page Latin American Healthcare Report. It's new and revised for 2020 and beyond. To get your copy, go to expatplanb.com. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.